the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab for Sunday, September 9th, 2012, show 416. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Cab, the show where you send in your questions, we provide some answers, you send in your tips, we provide some tips of our own, and sometimes if we have time, and sometimes we have a lot of time, we do a little thing we call Cool Stuff Found. Here, high atop the TMO Towers East in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
In the morning to you, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, scheduling it's forced us to do this show in the morning on Sunday as opposed to Sunday evening. We have a full chat room. I'd like to say hi to everybody in the chat room. Thanks for joining us off schedule today. Nice to see some recurring people and nice to see some new people that don't usually make it on Sunday evening. So, but it's been you've got some stuff going on tonight and tomorrow, and it's been a crazy week. Right. I'm going to apologize right out of the gate, John, for my voice. This week has been nuts. You know, as I said, we recorded the last show early while I went away to family camp where we sleep in cabins and we don't get a whole lot of, you know, it's not restful sleep like you would get at home. As soon as we got home, the first thing I did was I pushed show 415 live. And then starting about 4 in the afternoon, Adam Christensen, who works with us on the back end, and I started the Herculean task of migrating the Mac Observer from its existing design and engine to the new design that you see today and engine. And we did that for about 12 hours. So 4 a.m. or so, I got to sleep. I think Adam got to sleep at about 8 a.m. Eastern. Slept a couple hours, did that. Then I went to see Madonna that night, which was awesome. And but it was more bug fixing and, you know, triage and all that stuff on the site all week. I had a gig on Thursday, went and saw Rush Friday night. Still more triage. Yesterday, I played 2 gigs of my own, and now I'm here. So I haven't slept, and I've completely abused my throat. So we'll see how much all this cool processing stuff I have here helps get us through the show. How was your week, John?
Wow, look at that new site. Isn't that great? Look at that. Oh, look at everybody's pictures there. Everybody looking so serious. Wow, like it.
I love the site. The prime directive of the new site was clean, simple. And here's the thing about it. It drives me crazy. The web has changed, right? It drives me crazy to visit a website, and especially not the homepage, not so bad. But if I click on an article, it's insane to me that, and of course at TMO, we used to have this problem, but we fixed it. It's insane to me to look at, to load a web page for an article, clearly expressing the intent of wanting to read the article. And the top half of the page is cluttered with navigation to take me somewhere else. It's that to me is insane. So in this design process, that was kind of one of the first things we dealt with was, okay, let's just get people the article. And then if they express intent to go somewhere else, either scrolling down to the bottom or using the little cool little what are you looking for bar that we put at the top, you now can find other places to go. But if you click on an article, my assumption is you wanted to read the article. So that was one of the kind of the prime directives of the site. So I hope everybody likes it. Anyway, sorry, John, I'm ranting here. How was your week?
All right, well, let's get back on track here. Why don't we start with... Well, I didn't do much. I went to a gathering. Somebody, there are some links to some pictures there. There was an actual garage band. I thought that was kind of cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and car parts and all sorts of things. Yeah, different people would shift in and out of different roles, mostly guitar and percussion.
Cool.
All right. Jerry?
Yeah,
should
take
I,
it.
Should I
yeah,
do
yeah,
this? Should
yeah.
I grab the reins?
Grab the reins and go. Please grab all the right. reins and go.
This is the first one. I like this one. Okay, so this is from Jerry. Hi, Dave and John. Dave and John. Something has been bothering me for a while now, and it has to do with my Mac returning my daughter's name. We won't reveal his daughter's name, or can we?
No, we'll leave it out of it.
We'll leave it out. Because that's what we want to do in dialogue messages like this one. I happened to be looking around in the new messages app in Mountain Lion when this message popped up. And this is something that you see if you go into messages, like I said here, in the preferences or account preferences, I believe this is where you will see this message. And it'll say messages can use Bonjour to exchange messages and files with people on your local network. They will be able to browse for you as
insert daughter's name here. Right.
Yeah. Now, the problem, I guess Jerry was having is that he is not his daughter. He is Jerry. So he didn't. Well, he was just wondering why is this happening? And that actually had me scratching my head, too, because and he said he looked in user accounts. So he said what he tried to do. So he's looked in user accounts, but I only have three accounts and an admin account, I guess a Jerry account, and then a default guest account. So no
account with his daughter's name.
Right, which is,
So where's he getting it from?
Too.
Yeah.
And that's a good question. So there are a number of names that you are given, depending on what you're doing. So one, of course, is your account name, and he looked in the right place to get that. There are two other names. Well, at least one other name. So here's where I thought it was going to be, Dave, because it mentioned Bonjour, and I'm like, oh, well, yeah, Bonjour is the local sharing. So it's probably grabbing the, here's another thing you can set. And that's the machine name. So I figured, maybe his daughter named it, you know, her.
Sure.
And so where do you find that? Well, you go into system preferences, and it's in sharing. And you will see something, and it's been called different things. Now it's called computer name. And even under it, it says computers on your local network can access your computer at, and in my case, it's JV Mac Mini. And I'm like, oh, well, that's probably not it. And why do I say that? I should actually go to the troubleshooting that I tried to do. So I looked at my installation of messages, and I went to the same place that he looked, the account info, and it said other people will be able to find you as, now this is and isn't a surprise, John F. Braun. I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. And I'm like, well, wait a second. Where on my machine am I John F. Braun? Because my account name is John Braun. I don't put the F in there. I don't know why I don't, but I don't. But this helped. So I looked there. Nope, that wasn't it.
So where else is there to look?
Well, and that was the thing. It's like, well, where do I use my full name? Oh, I know. And now it's called contacts, or in the past, address book. And Dave, maybe you know more about this. And I looked in there, and John F. Braun I brought up the John F. Braun card, and then I remembered back in the back of my mind there's something that application asks you to do, and I'm not sure how it does it when you're first setting up a machine. Maybe it just defaults to. That's my question, but it was the card in contacts that I have marked as my card. So there's a card that is yours, and it presumably has your information,
right?
And various applications will latch onto this to do useful things. And one of them is messages saying, oh, well, if your card is your card, then that's probably how you want your name to appear to other people, because we assume that that's you. Of course, the other things that are you are your account name, as we discussed, and the computer name. But those weren't it. So as soon as I did this, so I created a new card and I called it New John. And then I selected that as my card, and instantly in messages in that preference, it changed it immediately. So that was kind of neat that I got live feedback that what I found was in fact it, that I didn't have to restart the app or restart or do anything. That was a nice touch. So I thought I was going to hit a dead end, but I didn't. So now the My Card, though, I mean, does that, I guess when you, if you install a machine fresh is.
I don't think if you install fresh, I don't think you have a My Card. That was my, it's been so long, so I could be wrong on this, but it will sync it down from iCloud and all of that stuff if you do it fresh. But if you truly like fresh without starting with anything else, I don't think you have a My Card. At least you didn't in the past. You have to go in and like you said, highlight a card and go to the card menu and choose Make This My Card.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that field would be blank if you haven't yet chose a My Card, or if it picks up another name to broadcast.
Or it might tell you, go set a My Card.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. You know, it's actually, that's worth testing with a guest user, or a test user account, I should say. But you can tell in address book, the My Card has like a little, it's like a generic avatar next to it that no other card has. It's like, it looks like a little human head, sort of nondescript thing. So All right. Moving on to Louis. Louis writes, I have a whole bunch of NAS volumes in my login items. Even though I selected the hide checkbox for each volume, they show up as opened windows whenever I boot my computer. Do you know any way to prevent the windows to open at boot time? It's no big deal, but I would expect the windows to be hidden since I used the hide checkbox. Of course, what he's talking about is in system preferences, users and groups, login items. You can list all the things that you want to have start up when you log in. And as we've mentioned in the past, they don't just have to be apps. They can also be volumes, right? So network volumes, which is exactly what he's talking about. But next to everything, whether it's a network volume, an app, a document, whatever it is, there is this checkbox that you can check labeled hide. And the interesting thing is that hide checkbox really only works on apps. It is meant to launch an app in the OS's hidden mode, as though you launched the app and went to the app menu and chose hide. So, you know, if you're launching mail, you go to the mail menu and you'll see an entry in there called hide mail. It means the app's launching, but the window isn't open. This just simply does not work in the Finder. So that's where doing it this way, there is no way. That's the kind of the long and short of it. There are other things you can do, though, to mount volumes at startup. One of them is using a piece of technology in OS X called AutoFS. And there was actually a great article on Low End Mac a couple of years ago about AutoFS, like a primer on AutoFS. And it requires getting your hands dirty with the terminal a little bit, actually a little more than a little bit. You just got to be comfortable moving around there. But that will let you launch things or let you mount volumes. And actually, AutoFS will keep them mounted even if they disconnect. So that can be a handy thing. I shared this advice with Louis, and he came back and said, yeah, I didn't want to mess with the terminal, so I launched Automator. And Automator has an action called get specified servers. And you can just list servers in there and it'll have them mount them. And so now he has this Automator action, launch at startup, run his, you know, it mounts his specified servers, and then the Automator action quits because it's done doing its thing. And so he said that has worked well, and now the windows don't all open. So I love it when there's multiple answers to a question, and I love it when you folks find one of those. So that's a good thing. Any thoughts on this, John, or are we ready to move on to Brian?
AutoFS, you said?
I did say AutoFS.
Yeah. That had I was actually looking because in the file system, I seem to recall something called FS tab. And actually I found a file which has a humorous little message in it. I thought there was something in ETC that would list this information here. And I actually found on my podcast machine here a file in ETC called fstab.hd. And when I look at it, it says, ignore this file. This file does nothing, contains no useful data, and might go away in future releases. Do not depend on this file or its contents.
That's it. Yeah, fstab used to be the way that you mounted things in Unix. I guess it's doing it a different way. I honestly thought it was still fstab, but OS X might be kind of doing its own thing. So I do not know. Ready to move on?
To Brian?
To Brian, yep.
You know, I bet you were hoping that I'd have the question up in front of me. And I do.
Awesome.
So Brian says, and this is a multimedia question. I like this one. So get ready to press the button.
Okay.
So Brian says, I have a late 2008 MacBook Pro, which is very close in vintage to mine, though mine is an early 2008. Recently, it's been making this noise when I awaken it from sleep. Bad hard drive? ? I'll read the rest. Can I replace this with an SSD? That's assuming that it's bad, I guess. If so, which brand or store offers the best price for a decent drive? I need around 120, 160 gigs. Thanks for keeping the show going. Well, you're welcome.
All right. So you want to hear the sound, John?
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Ready? I think that's it, my friend. So what name that sound?
And that's a cool little sound. Now, you know, it doesn't sound exactly like mine, but the rhythm of what it was doing did. And this is the DVD drive exercising the eject machinery, I believe, or some machinery. I think it depends.
Yeah, that's definitely the sound it makes when it ejects a disc. And I think what it's doing is, as it accesses the drive, it's this has always been my assumption. I have no confirmation on this, but my assumption is, you know, when it goes to access the DVD drive, it first tries to spin it. If there's a disc in there, if there's not a disc in there, it tries to sort of see, is there a disc and we need to wake it up? And then if not, it spits it out. So it sort of goes through its gyrations. And that's what I always assumed it was doing. It fits in my worldview.
So basically I got back to him. I said, well, number one, I'm positive it's the DVD drive. And so then I was scratching my head and thinking, well, how could I invoke this without waking the machine up? Excuse me. So I have one piece of data that he hears this when he wakes the machine from sleep. So one is normal, and my machine always does that. I think what threw him is that, well, he's hearing multiple times. I never heard that sound before. So I can understand that. But how do you get the machine to do this under user control without having to wake it? And then there are a couple of ways. So one, or at least this does it for me, is that if you start up Disk Utility, one thing that it does during its startup is it tickles or whatever the DVD drive, and it makes this sound.
That's a great technical term.
Well, that was the best.
Tickles. No, I like it. It's perfect. Yeah.
And it giggles. It makes a giggle sound, which.
Where are we going here?
Okay. So now here's a geekier way, though, to make this sound. Because then you got to start up and shut down Disk Utility. That's kind of a pain in the neck. But then I remembered and did a little Googling here and found something. There's a way in the terminal. Do not fear the terminal. But you can do this. And it's thanks to a command, which I haven't really used too often, called, I believe it's drutil. And if you do a man page on it, here's another tip. When you're in the terminal, type man space and then the name of something like drutil, and I got a man page on it. And the description of what it does is interact with CD/DVD burners. So this program is specifically for the drive. And the command that you can do to make the eject sound, that's why I'm tying this to eject, is the command is drutil space tray. I'm not sure what the other options are. Space eject. And when you do this, it makes the sound. So that's why I'm calling it the eject sound.
I like it. I would call it the eject sound. Yeah.
Drutil. Oh, yeah. You can do burn, eject, erase, info, list. Probably.
Yeah, there's burn? Tons of stuff.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Disk Utility, like many things in OS X, Disk Utility is just a nice face on a lot of different Unix commands. And in fact, there's many more things you can do with the terminal commands than you can do with Disk Utility, like setting a cap on the size of a sparse bundle and, you know, lots of those different things.
Nice.
Yeah, it's good. Speaking of setting a cap on the size of sparse bundles, that was one of our ways of limiting the size of Time Machine backups on network drives. But Snow Leopard, as longtime listeners will remember, ruined that because it would actually go in and strip that out of the sparse bundle and allow the sparse bundle to continue to grow. Lion and Mountain Lion do not do that. So if you do the trick where you set the size of a sparse bundle, and we'll find a link and put it in the show notes, that should still continue to work. And it's a nice way, if you have a network attached storage device like a time capsule or really anything, you can set the max size of the sparse bundle and effectively limit the available space for your Time Machine backups without having it just run rampant and take up all your space. So Mountain Lion and Lion fix that. So, all right, moving on to Dave. Dave says about twice a week, my computer will do something quite odd that's even somewhat hard to explain. I'll be using an application, not the same one each time, and instantly I can no longer quit that application with Command Q, nor bring any other application to the front. So essentially the app or any other becomes non-functional, even though the OS seems to be fine and working. It's like the OS stops bringing apps to the front. I know the two problems are related, quitting and using an app, and that I cannot use any application at all that's open unless I restart the computer, which does solve the problem. Yes, I know this sounds really weird, but I'm stumped. Literally, in a nutshell, every app on the computer will still be operating in the background, but I can't actually use any of them. The console log really explains the situation. It says application isn't in F-permitted front ASNS. That sums it up. The app is fine, but not able to be used since it's not in the front. I see the app, but can't use it. Any ideas, guys? It says on a late 2011 MacBook Pro with Mountain Lion. This never happened to me until Mountain Lion, though. Of course, this could be a problem with an app, too. I have seen this, and I have seen it pre-Mountain Lion, and I've seen it post-Mountain Lion. There are a couple of things that I have done to kind of unstick this problem. They don't all always work, but in order, the things that I first try are Command Tab to switch back and forth between apps. Sometimes that will bring an app to the front. Clicking on a different app, but of course Dave said he tried that. But if you folks see this problem, I find that sometimes, you know, I just have to like monkey with it. I can get an app in the front, but the window isn't highlighted, and so I can't interact with it. And I have to like click out maybe to the Finder, to the desktop, and then Command Tab my way back in or click my way back in. That sometimes works. If you can get the terminal open, oftentimes the dock or the menu bar can have some process going that screws things up. So the trick is you want to kill off and let the dock or the menu bar respawn. The dock is easy to remember. In the terminal, you type kill all, which is the easy way of killing a process by name. And in this case, you just type kill all space dock with a capital D, and that will kill the dock, and then the dock will relaunch. Sometimes that will fix this. Other times, the menu bar, but unfortunately, there's no process called menu bar. Here's a little trick that may be handy in other troubleshooting methods. John, do you know the process name for the menu bar off the top of your head?
Mr. Brown. Menu bar?
No.
Menu bar?
No, it's system UI server. I know, right? Really obvious that that's your menu bar. That's your menu bar. So you do a kill all space, and then it's system UI server, but you got to get capitalization right. So it's system with a capital S, UI, both capitalized, and then server with a capital S. So four capital letters, no spaces, kill all. Well, no spaces in that word. There's one space in the middle. Kill all space, system UI server. And that, again, just like killing off the dock, it'll kill off your menu bar and then bring everything back. And if you have third party stuff, it'll load up there. If you find that it's the menu bar that's doing it, take a look at your third-party utilities that you have in there, because you may wind up with one that's either incompatible with Mountain Lion, maybe, and maybe that's why you're seeing this problem more now, or, you know, something else. So check that out. Lastly, and again, all of this is predicated on the ability to get to the terminal. If you have to shut down your Mac, you know, just holding the power switch is probably, you know, one of the worst ways to do it. The worst is pulling the plug out of the wall. Holding down the power switch is, you know, second worst. The best way, of course, is restarting from the Apple menu. In the middle is a terminal command that's a little funky, but it's sudo, S-U-D-O, which gets you up as root, and you have to be in order to do this. So sudo space shutdown, bear with me here, space dash R, which means don't actually shut down, but restart, space now, because you have to tell it when you want this to happen. Unix lets you schedule shutdowns and restarts, but you want it to do it now. So sudo space shutdown space dash R space now. And that will, in most cases, force all your apps to quit. They won't necessarily quit pleasantly, so you may lose data. But at least your OS is shutting down properly, and you're not getting that, you know, weird caches that, you know, you're going through a proper shutdown process. So that's my thoughts on this one. You got any thoughts, John?
Totally out of left field.
I love that you play left field. It's like you're a star of left field.
Well, actually, no, I'm going to tell you my thoughts here. So the message, so he did give us a console message here, and it had something to do with a flag called F permitted front ASNs.
Right.
Okay. And now what that is, now you may ask yourself, what is F permitted front ASNs? What does this have to do with? And I'm going to tell you.
Go.
Has to do with Gatekeeper.
Really?
Yeah, I did a little searching, and I found a write-up here, which we'll link to. I'll link to. Better bookmark this. But basically it says, it was someone who was describing a problem that they had with not an app, but a Python script. And at one point what happened is it would act up, and he got this message in the console, which to me indicates that Gatekeeper is not happy about something. And it specifically says, you know, app whatever, try to be brought forward, but isn't in fprmitted front ASN, so denying. So it sounds to me like Gatekeeper is getting in the way, and it's a piece of garbage.
Okay.
No,
fair
maybe
enough.
Not. So what you got to do, and then he goes into detail here, and I haven't actually tried this, but if you go to our friend, the terminal, this is a terminal show. I didn't know it turned into that, but it is, because every question has gone to the terminal, right?
So far. Don't fear the terminal.
Let's keep it up.
We need cowbell for that.
That's the title of the show.
Actually. Totally. Right. I had actually already put that in as the title of the show when you said it earlier. But
anyway, so it's SPCTL is the command. And of course, how do you learn what it does? Well, you do a man SPCTL. And what is this? Oh, hold on. Not found. Oh, I typed Mac.
You fat fingered it, didn't you?
Yeah. SEC assessment system policy security. Now, actually, I probably wouldn't mess with this too much. But one thing that is suggested is, well, two suggestions that were given in the article. One is you could disable protection. And to do that, you type SPCTL space --master-disable. I think that turns off Gatekeeper in general. Probably not something you want to do forever. we'll have to find more information on this, or you or I will have to try to do this. Then it says, the other thing you could do is add the appropriate rule to allow this app to run. And I don't know how to do that. So, yet.
All right.
It could take a bit of doing, but we gave you the command. We gave you a way to disable it to... Yeah, it sounds to me like some flag, either that database is corrupted or some flag in the app. I haven't done enough work with Gatekeeper other than setting it, you know, to be either all none or in between. I haven't really done any work. Do you know if there's any? I mean, there has to be ways other than this SPCTL via the command line in order to fiddle with Gatekeeper. Maybe not.
Well, there is that one option in. Let's see, it's in system preferences. I believe it's security and privacy, where you have allow applications downloaded from, and then you've got three options: Mac App Store, and identified developers, and anywhere. And I believe setting it to anywhere, my understanding was that killed off Gatekeeper from doing anything. So that would be an interesting test as to see if that solves it too without mucking with the terminal. Yavo, our first sponsor for this show is Gazelle. Gazelle.com, great place to go and sell your Apple related or your Apple products, used Apple products, old stuff that you aren't using or might not be using soon. And the reason I say that is there's this event happening on Wednesday morning in San Francisco, and I'm actually heading out to it. I got invited, so I'll go ahead and do our TMO live coverage there. But of course, the rumors seem to think that it's going to be the iPhone 5 or the new iPhone. I'm not sure what the name's going to be, but that doesn't matter. If you are the type of person that would want to get an iPhone 5 and sell your iPhone, whatever that you have, visit Gazelle. I recommend visiting Gazelle before the 12th. And here's why. You go to Gazelle, you put in whatever device you have and type in, you know, and type in the condition and all this stuff, and it'll give you a price. Here's the trick. That price is locked for 30 days. So 30 days gives you time to get the new iPhone, and then you migrate over to the old one. Then you still have time. You send your old one into Gazelle and you get your money. But the thing is, you know, come ship date of this new iPhone, assuming that's what it is, you're not going to get the same price that you would today. So get on top of it, lock that in. And you know what? If you lock it in, you've got 30 days to send it in. If you don't send it in, it just cancels the order. It doesn't cost you anything, but at least you're locked in and ready to roll. So check it all out. Gazelle.com. You can sell other things there too, of course, iPods, They take MacBooks. They take iPhones, of course, iPads. So go ahead and check it out. Gazelle.com, really, really simple interface. Just a couple of clicks and you'll have all your answers. So yeah, check it out. Gazelle.com. Tell them we sent you. They're good folks. I've sold stuff to them and it's always gone very, very smoothly. So Gazelle.com. Thanks for sponsoring the show. All right. Ron has a question. Very interesting question. Ron says, so we've gone through some quick ones here, right, John? So Ron's might stretch things out a little bit. Ron says, I'm the fortunate owner of a new 15-inch MacBook Pro with a Retina display. And while it's the finest computer I have ever owned, I've had a couple of weird occurrences. Yesterday, suddenly, I could no longer access the internet. I was on my home Wi-Fi network. Network utility said there was no problem, and I had a valid IP address. My Lion old MacBook Pro, my wife's Lion MacBook Pro, my iPad, my iPhone, all accessed the web without issue. Nothing connected from my machine. Not Safari, not Dropbox, not SugarSync. Safari started to access the URL. The blue progress bar started to move, then stalled indefinitely. I checked the firewall. I restarted. I reset Safari. I cleared cookies, caches, etc. I reset the PRAM. I reset the SMC. I started in safe mode. I repaired permissions. I restarted my modem and Airport Extreme. I spoke with Apple support. No luck to any of these. They kicked me up to an Airport Extreme specialist. While I was waiting, I accessed my test account. It seems in Mountain Lion, you can only get to it via safe mode. That seems weird. But the problem persisted there. I restarted into my main user account just as the support guy was speaking to me, and lo and behold, internet came back. I have no idea what happened, not even sure where to start other than the routine stuff, and no idea why it recovered. It may be true and unrelated, but only my 10.8.1 MacBook Pro was affected. Interested into your thoughts on troubleshooting this, should it recur. P.S. How do I do a ping to a website? All right, so let's talk about this. I've seen problems like this before, and when it looks like everything is set, we have to take a step back and remember how the internet works. And the internet works on IP addresses. You don't connect to computers by name. Your computer connects to other computers by number, IP addresses, either IPv4 or IPv6, which is, you know, sort of being migrated into our worlds here. But either way, it's a series of numbers. Well, you and I, we don't like to have to remember those numbers, so we use names like www.macobserver.com. But your computer doesn't connect to www.macobserver.com. It connects to the address that it translates from that name. And in order to do that translation, it has to check in with what's called a domain name server or a DNS server. DNS server. If your DNS server is either not responsive or responding incorrectly, everything will stop working very, very quickly because it's kind of the system that everything is, that's the linchpin here, if you would. When you have a problem like this, and when I have a problem like this, the first thing I do is I launch System Preferences and I go into Network and I go into, make sure I get this right because it's sort of an interesting path. You choose your network device, so Ethernet or Wi-Fi. You click Advanced and go to the DNS tab. It should be pre-populated with a gray DNS address. That's the one that your router has assigned to your computer. But you can put your own in here. And I highly recommend testing it with your own. The one that I always use because I can remember it very easily is Google's public DNS server, which is 8.8.8. You guessed it, 8. 4 eights, dots in the middle. I just put that in there. I hit the plus button, put 8.8.8.8 in there. 8.8.8.8, not the fifth one, sorry. And hit OK, hit apply. Now my computer's using DNS from Google. You can test this. The easiest way to test it is in the terminal with a command called nslookup name system or name server lookup. Type nslookup space and then the address www.macobserver.com. It's going to give you a probably a 5-line answer First, it's going to tell you your server and address. That should be, in this case, now 8888. But otherwise, it's going to tell you what your domain name server is. And then it's going to give you, it's probably going to say non-authoritative answer. That's okay. That means you're just checking your local DNS server and not the master for that domain. And that's normal. And then it'll give you the name back, which should be www.macobserver.com. And then the address. There might be, it might say there's a canonical name and it might give you a couple of addresses, but you should eventually get to an address that works. If you're looking up macobserver.com, it should end in .218 these days. So that's one way to test it. As far as pinging, same thing from the terminal, except you're using the command ping, P-I-N-G, and you can put a name in there or a number. If you know the number of a server you want to ping, that's handy. You put that in, and assuming the server responds to pings, it'll come back and start telling you how long each ping took. A ping is just how long it takes from a request from your computer to get to the remote computer and back. And that can give you an idea as to whether there's a connection difficulty. I will warn you one thing about ping. Once you start it, it will not stop on its own. So you're just going to see a terminal window filling up once per second with ping requests. Control C is the magic answer to stop it. So hopefully that helps you all troubleshoot this type of stuff when it comes in. Hopefully it makes sense from a sort of top level as to why DNS is really kind of the first thing to check, because it's so important in everything. And if it craters, doesn't matter how fast your internet connection is, it's just not going to work. So any thoughts on that, my friend?
Oh boy. First, old fuddy-duddies use NS lookup. You should get with the cool kids and use dig.
Yeah, I do use dig. Yeah. You're right.
It's another command. There may be a newer one.
No, I think you're right. Dig. Yeah. But dig gets weird. I'm used to, because I'm an old fuddy-duddy, I'm used to the output from from NS lookup.
And the other one, I thought you were going down this path, but you didn't. You veered away at the last moment. But there is a network diagnostics.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, go ahead. Tell them about
normally,
that.
Normally, so if the Mac detects a connection problem, often you will get a dialogue saying, "Whoa, there's something messed up. I'm going to run network. Can I run?" Or I think it just starts running network diagnostics. I think it asks you. It's like, something's up. Can we run network diagnostics? But you can invoke this manually. And how do you do this manually? And that's why I thought you were going down this path, Dave. So it's in the same place that Dave went, and that you go to System Preferences Network. But then on the bottom of the screen, you're going to see a button that says Assist Me, ... And you click on that, and at least on this machine, it'll say, oh, do you need some help setting up a network, or do you have some problems? And there's Cancel, Diagnostics, ... and Assistant. So you hit diagnostics, and then you'll see something called network diagnostics starting to run. It's going to ask you which interface to test and tell you, is it your ISP? Is it the internet? Is it the server? It does its best to guess where the problem resides. And invoking that manually certainly couldn't hurt.
No, that's a great idea.
It may help, and it may help identify which part of the network. Though it sounds like what was already done was pretty methodical. This helps guide you if you're not sure of the steps to take.
Well, your suggestion of staying in the graphical user interface reminded me of something else that lives in the graphical user interface, which is network utility. It lives inside applications, utilities. And when you launch it, at least in Mountain Lion, it's got 8 tabs at the top. One of them, the third, is ping. The fourth is lookup. And that's going to do these same lookups that we just walked you through in the terminal without you having to go to the terminal. And
it shields you from the horror of the terminal.
Don't fear the terminal, man. But that actually is probably the best way to go if you're not comfortable with the terminal. So definitely network utility is the way. Yet again, hitting the terminal here, John. This is really funny, actually, because I didn't even notice it as I was putting the agenda together, which is even better. So cool. Are we ready for Ralph?
Yes.
All right, let's do Ralph.
I don't know if we have an answer, but hey.
All right.
Hi, John and Dave. There we go. So I've heard of very little. All right, I gotta digest this or parse this. So I've heard of few issues with Mountain Lion and decided to upgrade my late 2008 MacBook Pro 5.1. Seems fine until last night when I was watching a screencast online video. The machine stuttered, had an error, and shut down on its own. Ooh. Wow, that's bad. After that, it seemed okay. Today, however, whenever I log in and use an admin account, it seems to log me out automatically after only a couple of minutes. Strange thing, if I log in using my wife's admin account, no issues. I upgraded right on top of an existing Lion OS. I'm thinking about wiping the drive and doing a fresh install. Before I do, any ideas what could be causing this auto logout issue? I've included the error reports and included some crash reports and panic reports. Thanks, Ralph. I didn't see anything in the reports, Dave.
No, I didn't either.
And I tried to lead him down one path, but I don't know, I think he came up with anything. But in the console, which isn't the terminal, but you shouldn't be afraid of that either. So in the console, you may see reasons for a shutdown, and I certainly did. So I did a search in my console and typed in the find field, I typed shutdown. And sure enough, you know, when the Mac is doing a shutdown, it may log that. And in my case, it said, I found a line. It said, you know, here's the time and date stamp, shutdown, halt by John Braun, which is my account name. And then it says shutdown time. Now, I didn't look at the lines surrounding that, but that gives you a place to start because the lines surrounding that may show reasons for the shutdown. Now, in this case, it's pretty straightforward. You know, it said halt by John Braun, which means that the admin, which is me, invoked halt.
Sure.
Saying shutdown. And it's like, oh, okay, this is the person responsible for it or account or process. So, but he didn't find anything related to that. The only other thing is that the Mac can appear to have a life of its own or a mind of its own. But he didn't find anything here either. So it's a two strikes. But it may help other people solve a problem like this. System preferences, energy saver. There's a schedule button.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really use this, but some people may. You know, you want regularity in your life. But click on schedule. You can tell your Mac to, in this case, shut down at a certain time. Or you can also tell it to, I believe, most Macs, most recent ones, maybe not the older ones, to start up at a certain time. Isn't that fun? So you can... So you could freak out either your family or your friends in that you can, you know, appear to be commanding your Mac from afar and telling it to turn on when you're not touching it.
But
he didn't see anything. Because I think it's possible that there could have been entries made in here that would cause the machine to shut down when it seems that it shouldn't be. But that wasn't it either. So two strikes. Right. Sorry, Ralph.
I was going to say I use the schedule thing for on the machines that I know I want to have run like scheduled syncs or whatever, I make sure the machine is awake to do that. A lot of backup software actually will kind of manage that on their own, but you can do that here too. One other thing, you know, he said he was watching a video when the machine stuttered, and it's a laptop. So I might make the assumption, and I'm going to make the assumption, at least for the sake of this discussion, that perhaps it was on his lap. Running a video likely is going to tax either the graphic processor or the main CPU to decode that video and display it on the screen. I know Don does everything in HD. Don McAllister, that is, of Screencast Online. And so it's possible that he was running a video that was in some way taxing his system. When your system is taxed, especially your CPU or your graphics processor, when any processor is taxed, it starts to heat up like it's supposed to. And the Mac has its own cooling stuff. But, you know, Steve Jobs was crazy in this case, in a very good way. He didn't want, you know, battle fans on this thing. But that means that it is more susceptible to overheating, especially if A, you are insulating the bottom of it with your legs. And then, of course, B, adding your own body heat to the mix from your legs. Or even worse, if you're in bed and you have it like on top of the covers, it totally insulates it and can make it so the machine cannot cool itself down fast enough. When your Mac gets to the point where the CPUs are reporting temperatures outside of their operating ranges, your Mac will shut down. It's its way of saving itself from burning itself out, essentially. You don't want to cook one of your processors. And the way to save it is to just shut down. I think when that happens, usually when that happens, you get a message as to why that's happening. But it's possible that it's just going to do it and say, nope, I'm done. And so that, you know, that I think is what was going on with the first one. It's summertime. You know, it's warmer out, might have been warm in your house, you know, no ambient cooling happening. So that was my thought for that. As far as the auto logout of the admin account, that's really weird. That's one I would watch the terminal from. This is here we are in the terminal again. This is one of those situations where I love having either another Mac or just my iOS device around. I log in with a terminal program remotely. Now, to do this, you have to go into System Preferences, Sharing, and turn on Remote Login. And then you can use a command called SSH. And in fact, it'll put the command to access that Mac right there in the sharing preference pane. So mine says, you know, type SSH Dave at iMac Studio. And then that would let me, because I'm in the studio on this one here. And then that would let me connect to it either from another Mac or you could do it. I use ISSH on my, on my iPhone and my iPad. And it's really handy at that point to watch one of the system logs. Now this starts, you think we were geeky before. I use a command called tail. And I would do tail dash F, I think. And it's going to be /var/log/ system, right? System.log. That will show you the system log, and anytime anything's added to it, it will just keep scrolling. The tail command just follows it along. And so you can watch that, and then when you see your machine log out, take a look at the system log and see what it says. It's going to tell you. You know, you're probably going to get something in there, but that's the way to watch the console from remote. It would be cool if the console app had a way to do that from remote, and maybe it does, but I have never looked for it, so... Thoughts on that, or is it time to move on to Sam?
Sam? Yeah, all right.
Ready? Ready? No? All right.
I think so, yeah.
All right, cool. Sam writes, Sam, of course, is our friend from the UK, who we mentioned in the last show as Spam in the chat room. He says, I'm just moving to Mountain Lion on all of my Macs, resorting things out, and I'd like to know what you think about archiving. When do you choose to take a document off of a drive or machine that is regularly in service and commit it to an archive? I have to say, over the years, with drives getting bigger and bigger, archiving hasn't been an issue. If I keep the file on the main drive, I know that it's being regularly spun up and backed up in multiple locations, and then I feel safer than committing it to a drive on a shelf. There's one backup, there are archives. When do you stop? As I work with large audio and video files, the need for keeping myself in order and having as little on my current drive as possible is really important. Yet I need to have older projects at hand easily should I need to recall anything. I wonder if I can do something clever with a NAS with drive redundancy, like the Synology unit you had to archive off to, but keep a copy available that I could access over the internet if I was away from home. Rather than try and solve my particular issue, I thought it would be really useful to have a geek discussion over what various people are doing, particularly people that work with large files and projects that have to regularly choose what to offload where and how. All right. I'm sure we're going to pass this around and have different opinions on this, John. As far as like regular work documents, I'm sort of in the drives have been getting larger and it doesn't matter category. I still do backups, obviously. And I still do quarterly archives where I just take everything and archive it off and then don't touch it again so that I've got these pictures of the past, if you will. But there are those things like the iPhoto library and all the raw audio files from the GeekGab, right, that I need to save somewhere. And I've actually been using the NAS drives for that because I can just keep dumping storage at them. And the nice part about them, you said you wanted to access from the internet. Well, with something like this Synology disk station, that's really, really easy. There's many different ways. I can use their cloud station. I can just use their file browser and browse any file on there from my iPhone or my Mac. I can access it that way. And so that keeps the data out there. And then I added the third party crash plan client, or I guess it's a client, to my disk station. And so any data I put out there, I can specify which directories get backed up to CrashPlan. So I dump stuff to the crash, to the disk station. Then it takes care of offsite backup, backing it up, and it's on all the time. So I don't need to worry about, is my Mac awake, and this, that, and the other thing. So that's how I do it. Because there are those things that just get big, you know, photos and pictures, or photos and music, and especially video. But, you know, I used to use DVDs for that. I've become weary of trusting DVDs that I'm not reading regularly. Putting something on the shelf and leaving it for years is a surefire way to ensure that it will not work when you try to access it years down the road. So I try to keep all my archives in active media that I'm regularly accessing, so that I know I have a way of getting to it when I need to, and it's not in some stasis point that might not be stasis. That's my thoughts on it, John. What do you got?
I do pretty much what you do, at least for some things. So yep. The largest storage I have is the Drobo FS, and right now I think I have about 4 terabytes. Terabytes? Never thought I'd be saying terabytes.
No, yeah.
Which is nowhere near full. I'm looking at it right now, and I have 2 LEDs lit up, 2 of the blue LEDs, so it means I'm using about 20%, I think, of the available space. But what I do is, so I copy it. So all of my movies I have on the NAS, pictures, which are either standalone or typically like a Aperture Vault or an iPhoto Vault. So, all right, so we have the video, images, I'm looking here, iTunes, so I'll back up my iTunes library. So normally I keep my iTunes library on my Mac Mini for all my devices, and music. So that's all in one place, but I back it up to the NAS as well. And then, of course, Time Machine on both of them, and then using various, you know, third-party things, like I'm on the crash plan trial as well. Though the one I rely on most, I think the one I like the most, and I actually had to get working, and maybe I'll talk more about this later, but SugarSync I like to back up key documents to the cloud as well. So it may not sound like there's much order or logic to what I said, but it works for me. Yeah, it's
well, that's it, is you find what works. Yeah.
Yeah, but mostly for large inactive files or blobs of data, I like to toss them on the NAS because I trust that. And then typically I don't create another copy of those because I figure the media is. Well, no, in a sense I do. That's right, because they're in a library, but then I also copy them on the NAS. So they're at least in 2 places. So.
Cool.
And the cloud.
And the cloud. Yeah, right. The, right. Yeah.
Can I tell you what grief I had with them?
Yeah, tell us your tale of woe, man.
Because I think you've been through it too, and it was really bothering me. And I so SugarSync. Oh, let me see if I can get that article. I'm unprepared. Oh gosh.
That's all right. Well, no, you called an audible, so it's, you know, it's all right. You want me to share a tip with them while you find it?
Oh no. So what was happening? So SugarSync was it seemed after one point in time, all of a sudden my MacBook Pro, SugarSync stopped working. It would launch and then it would quit. I would see the UI come up. And I was like, what is going on here? And so I searched around online. And then I dug into the terminal. And this, I think, was the key here. And then I dug into, the console. And I saw something happening. When the machine was starting up, it would say something along the lines of, permissions on this file are suspect or suspicious. I'm not going to launch it. And I'm like, huh? And it was something called, this is something that SugarSync uses, that then I started seeing the light, and it's a process called SCXFSMOND, which I guess is their background daemon. I don't know why it's not called SugarSync.
Well, that would be obvious.
What's SCXFSMOND? But that's them. So, and actually searched around for that term and found other people had the exact same problem. And I think one of the... you know, one of the articles was actually, you know, SugarSync crashing after I upgraded to Lion. So I think it had something to do with Lion and maybe something to do. I still think that maybe they worked something in their installer. Well, but it works fine on my other machine. Yeah, I still don't get it. But I looked it up and basically someone said, you know, I had the same problem and there's a couple of things you could do. So one was to chmod, I think, on the SCXFSMOND file.
And for those of you that don't know, again, now we're back to the terminal, right? Chmod changes the permissions of the POSIX permissions, which is the plain old standard Unix. I forget what POSIX stand for. Anyway, it lets you change the Unix permissions of a file.
So there were two things. I have the article on the machine that I think is almost dead. Let me see if I can bring it up. But it suggested two things. And between these two things, everything was fine. So one was the chmod. I think you had to bring it to 644. I think it was 666.
Okay, yeah.
But so whatever.
Sixes are read, write, and execute. I think 644 or fours are read and execute.
Here's the article. Okay. All right. Now I'm back on track here. Now, sorry about that. All right. So here are the two fixes that worked for me. So one was sudo chmod 644. I'm sorry, to the plist file that launches this thing. And that's in library launch daemons com.sharpcast.xfsmon.plist. So doing a chmod on the plist file, I'm sorry, not the file itself, but the file that launches it, that was suspect. And then the other thing, there was another suggestion later in the article. I had to do this as well, in that the group that it belonged to, I think it was under admin or the owner, that was also broken. So the owner should be, or it seems to help, at least in my case, if you change it to /wheel. Mine was /admin. So basically what was happening is there were problems with this plist file. All of a sudden, something bad happened, and a lot of people were not able to run SugarSync anymore because this plist file wouldn't invoke this xfsmond daemon properly. And then once I did those two things, then everything worked fine.
Cool.
It was bugging me. And I went, I tweeted it out. I went to their support. I saw some mentions in their data. I just can't imagine that I'm the only one that had that problem.
But you are not, actually. I had the same problem. And here's the really frustrating part about it. I went through SugarSync support and finally got to the point where I did a remote access session with them. And it was on this machine. It was on the studio machine here. Exact same problem, exact same solution. The really funny part is when I first started having this problem, I looked in the console log, I saw that message, and we talked about it. You and I did. And I have no idea why I didn't think to go muck with those permissions then. And so I went around and around and around. All my other machines were working. Same exact situation that you went through. And this one would not do it. And then as we were doing the support thing, he brought up he did a lot of things, and then he brought up the log. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, oh yeah, I've been here before. I'm like, dude, do we just need to change the permissions on this? He's like, yeah, that's going to be the problem. And sure enough, exactly what you went through. So it's weird. But anyway, you're not alone, my friend. I do have some clarifications to make so that we can make them in this show and not the next show. POSIX is a portable operating system interface. I'll thank that Michael in the chat room for that. And then Unix permissions, 4 is read only, 6 adds write ability. So 2 would be write ability, 4 is read only. And so together they are 6. Execute is a single bit. So if you want to add execute, it would be 7. So when you say it was 644, that means the owner of the file can read it. The group members and anyone or everyone has the owner can read and write to it. Everyone else only has read access to it. That's what 644 does. So just to get those clarifications out there, I found a nice little permissions calculator. And so I put that.
So I think what it was doing. So something in the OS was saying, you know what? These permissions seem too generous. So I think somebody's trying to hack you. So I'm just not going to launch this.
Yeah.
And that it was seeing that groups that it didn't think should have write access had write access. Because, now that I think back, I think I saw mine was 666.
Yeah, and it didn't want to. And it's smart of the system to not want to run a file that can be written to by everyone. Because the risk is what you could do is this process is going to be run with either full permissions on the system or some sort of enhanced permissions on the system, and it's able to delete files and do some potentially dangerous things. The issue is if the file is set as writable by anyone, it's possible for someone else to go and edit that script and change what it does. And then the system's just going to automatically launch it when it comes back up. So the system's smart enough to check and say, hey, wait a minute, that file's writable by the world. I'm not going to run it because I, you know, we have no idea who has touched it last. So that's what's going on here. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing. So fun stuff. All right. We got time for some tips, Sean. I'll read Scott's first and then you've got a couple here. We've got some good stuff here. We've got a follow up from Scott. Show 413. We talked about Java and jar files and things like that. And Scott offers some clarification for us that I wanted to pass along. Scott says the .jar file is actually a zip file that contains the Java bytecode program and any resources necessary to run the Java program. Think of the .jar file as an app package that is not a directory, which is really, really smart, right? There needed to be a portable way that worked on multiple operating systems to have what we know on OS X as a package. Now, of course, in OS X, the package is a folder, and that presents some weird problems, right? Because, you know, when you try to move it to different file systems, it can break and you can have some problems. So the Java folks that came up with this idea said, well, let's just use a zip file. Every OS will see it as a single file, but really it's just a collection of all these things and you can compress it. So good. And then he says for Lion and Mountain Lion, Java is not allowed to start by default. And in Mountain Lion, you have to actually download Java from Oracle. In order to allow Java, close your browsers and any other program that requires it. In the Finder, go to Applications Utilities and find the app called Java Preferences. Double click that icon and start the program under the General tab at the top. There is a checkbox to enable Java. Click it and you're done. You will not have to do this again unless you disable Java because of a security bug. That's true, but I think this started in Lion, but it's certainly true in Mountain Lion. If you don't use Java for a period of time, and I think it's a month, that checkbox will disable on its own. So if you're not regularly running it, it will turn itself off. Or the OS will turn it off. And that's a security measure. The concept being, if you're not regularly using Java, you probably don't need it. And so let's close this security hole and at least make it so that you have to go and enable it. And the OS will give you a little message and you just say, yeah, enable it. I want to use it for whatever app this is. But if you're not using it, it turns it off to keep it from running without your knowledge, which is smart. I think that's a good way to do security. It balances convenience and protection. You got some tips for us, John?
I got a tip here. So there was something that you've mentioned in the past, Dave, where I thought you were insane or hallucinating or something.
Well, I was, and I am now, but that's a different story. Good. Yes.
But you had made mention, I think, in the past that some applications would quit themselves if they were in the background for a certain amount of time. And I'm like, huh, well, I've never seen that. And I think I found out why. So I actually came across it. Why was I looking for that? Oh, no, I was going into secrets. Secrets is my favorite pref pane because it tells you all sorts of secrets. These little things you can set in the terminal for the most part. And they also offer a pref pane that makes it a little less dangerous to do what they suggest. But apparently I had the setting looking in the secrets pane. And I don't know if I intentionally set this or it just happened to come up that way. But my system was set up not to do this. And that there was I'm trying to find the name of the feature here, but I also found an article. So there's also an article on the web that tells you how to do this in OS X. Hints article called Disable Automatic Application Termination in OS X. And the other way to do it, and this is secrets ties into this often, the terminal. So what you would do is you would go to the terminal and you would say defaults, write, -g, ns, disable automatic termination, -bool, true.
And the good news is you don't have to remember that because you found a Mac OS X hints article
yes.
that talks about it. So I'll put that in the show notes.
And it's also a option in secrets and mine was checked. So that's why it just didn't register when you said you thought you saw this happen. I'm like, I've never seen that happen. And the thing is I haven't.
Huh? Interesting. Interesting.
But it's interesting how they hide it, and there's no way for the user normally, unless right. you just listen to this and get it, to do this. And I don't know, is this something that people would want to enable? Actually, I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Wait,
do you find it useful that it does this when you do notice that it's happening? Or
I like it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because I am of the school of thought that OS X is not great at managing memory to the point where you can just leave all your apps open all the time and let it figure it out. I want to quit apps that I'm not running, and I even do that on my iMac with 12 gigs of RAM, and it pays off. So I highly recommend it, but especially when you're podcasting, it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yavo. All right, we had a note from Tom on Twitter, and Tom said, we were talking about guest login on our Mountain Lion machines and it being enabled. And Tom said he found an article that says allowing guest login enables the Find My Mac service of iCloud. And it's an Apple support article, talks all about this stuff. But that may very well be why the guest accounts were enabled, because when you enable Find My Mac, it turns this on. Now, one thing that's interesting that I found in this article, if you have File Vault on and guest users enabled, what it says is when File Vault is turned on, guest users can only log in and use Safari. Guests can't access your File Vault encrypted disk or create files. Instead, they log in and use Safari from your computer's built-in recovery disk. And one of the reasons it does that is it allows Find My Mac to work, because when somebody launches Safari, it's accessing the internet and your Mac can phone home to Apple, and then you can use the Find My Mac service. So that is how that works. It's a honeypot, if you will, right? And then we call it a honey trap. What do we call that, John? Where, sort of, I guess. Maybe it's not a honeypot, but it's a way of
honeycomb.
I don't know what it is. It's something funny, honey. But it's your Mac's way of phoning home to Apple. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I found it interesting. I also found that it's wrong.
Okay.
In that my MacBook Pro is running Mountain Lion.
Yes.
Find My Mac is enabled.
Okay.
And the guest user is disabled.
But did you disable it?
Yes.
Well, okay.
What I guess I want to make clear is that it's not necessary to have the guest user activated in order for Find My Mac to work.
And have you confirmed this, that Find My Mac works?
Yes.
All right, good.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. Now, here's what I did, though, because, I was discussing this with, was it Tom?
It was Tom. Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm almost positive, though, I was tweeting at work, not that I tweet at work. Well, sometimes it was during lunch.
Right.
I was taking my lunch Twitter break.
Of course it was.
So, and I said, I'm almost positive that I have it on my machine and the guest is off. And so I looked at my machine when I got home and I looked in Find My Mac and there was a little warning sign next to it. So first I looked to make sure the guest was off, and guest was off. Then I went to Find My Mac and noticed that there was a little warning sign, or like a little caution, three-sided yellow thing.
Yeah.
Which indicated that it wasn't quite working. Well, here, so you may be thinking, oh, well, duh, John, that's because the guest user was off. No, it's because location services was off.
Oh, right.
So I went to location services, didn't touch the guest user. The guest user was not turned on, and eventually Find My Mac, because it uses Wi-Fi for positioning.
Right.
So sometimes that takes longer than a GPS-enabled device like an iPhone. So, and eventually, it's funny because I think I clicked on a checkbox somewhere once I tried to do this, and it said, oh, would you like me to email you once I do find your computer? Like, dude, that's so cool.
That's awesome. That's
and it did.
Great.
Once the Wi-Fi location service kicked in. Now, what I did notice, though, is that if you turn off, did my voice just, oh gosh.
No, you're okay.
I'm out of liquids here.
Yeah, I know. Well, we're almost.
Espresso.
We're almost done.
Yeah, I know. Okay. We're in the home stretch here.
That's right.
But what I noticed was Oh gosh, lost my train here. So I was finding, oh, I'm sorry. If I turned off, so if I went and turned off location services, so it was iCloud, system preferences, iCloud. If I turned off Find My Mac and then turned it back on, that would activate the guest user. So I'm wondering if the guest user on is not a requirement, but a side effect of fiddling with Find My Mac.
I think that's probably right. I think side effect
is perfect.
I think
it's a side effect. And so I'm actually kind of concerned because I think when we started talking about this or people started making us aware of this, the thing is, I think in general, having the guest user on is probably a bad thing if you don't know that it's on. And in this case, it turns it on really without telling you.
Yeah, but I think if you turn on, I agree with that. Yes, it turns it on without telling you, without question. But I think if you use File Vault, which I highly recommend to anyone using a laptop, because it works so well in Lion and later File Vault 2 is this, you know, the whole disk encryption. It keeps your machine secure. But it also, if you're using File Vault, you know, as I explained, it's very, what the guest user can do is very limited. And so it's really not a risk to have it on because it's not even decrypting your main partition. So that's a good thing. And the other good thing is that the band was ready to roll. Right, John?
I'm ready to roll.
All right.
Out of here. Before we roll out of here, we got to prime the pump here and get more. Help you folks. Help us. Help you.
Help us. Help
and
you.
One way you could do that is we could tell you how to get in touch with us. And I'd say the easiest way is to send an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
John, you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Yes, I did say feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And if you're a premium supporter, premium@macgeekgab.com is for you and will always be for you. I am going to say something about premium. We had said that part of the premium trends, the changes in premium have happened in a kind of elongated transition here. And we are in the home stretch of it. We've obviously got the new back end for TMO up. The premium, there is actually at this point in time no way to purchase a new premium subscription. And that's because we're moving to a different system. We needed to have the new TMO back end live and online. And now we're finishing that up, which actually very, very close. But we want to make sure we get it right because we're dealing with, you know, your personal information and all of this stuff. So we've got our EV SSL certificate and all that. But the engine, we're over testing this thing is what's happening. So hopefully I would say Monday or Tuesday this thing should come online. But we're not going to roll it until it's ready. I know that. It is what it is. We want to make sure it's right. So, stay tuned and stick around. Next Sunday, those of you that are in the chat room with us, I think we're going to have a fun little announcement. Actually a fun big announcement and you can take part in that and perhaps, you might even win things. So, but anyway, we'll talk about then Sunday. If you're there, you'll be the first to know about it. So,
do not send anything to Feedbag.
Feedbag. Oh, that'd be funny. And now I'm going to have to put that in as an alias, aren't I? You can call us at 206-666-KEEK, which, John, is
4335.
Sure is. You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. You can leave us iTunes comments on iTunes, to which we have no way of responding. And, awesome. It's awesome.
I like that ringing endorsement.
Did you like that? Yeah. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab is a great place to know when we're going to do these live streams, but also just interact with us and all sorts of good stuff. Tell them about Twitter, John.
It's a service.
Tell them how to find us on Twitter.
I'm John F. Braun. Awesome. He's Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab. And the publication is Mac Observer.
Outstanding. We would like to thank Michael Johnston. He is the host of the We Have Communicators podcast, but he also is the one who converts this show to AAC for you and for us every week. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. Of course, this podcast was sponsored by Gazelle. Also in the podcast marketplace is Barebone Software and Smile Software. All through Backbeat Media. A successful show. Our voices seem to hold out this morning, John. That was good. We're going to see everybody in a week, but John, do you have any perhaps lasting advice you might want to share?
Lasting. It's eternal. And don't get caught.
Made up.
I think we got caught. I think the outro got cut off.
John. I heard something. Yeah, I heard something drop out.
That was interesting. I don't know.